Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening, depending on where in the country you are. I'm very disappointed that May Cobb is not with us live tonight, but at 117, we thought it was probably too dangerous for her health and yours. So we are doing this virtually, but my hope is that May, who has been, for various reasons, has not been able to get to the pen during COVID and the rest, we hope to get her here this fall. Meantime, here's her new book, A Likeable Woman, with a really, you know, did people wear bathing suits like this? I'm fascinated.
I don't think anymore. I think that's sort of like a nod to the 90s kind of. Yeah. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. I'm just struck with the engineering of the the bra here. And I thought to myself, I wonder seriously if anybody wears one like that anymore.
I have one in a while. Yeah.
Right. But anyway, it is indeed, you know, cool blue by the pool and looks great. Once again, May has written what would you call this book? A dramedy?
I think so. I think it's more dramatic than my others, which were, you know, more salacious and just women behaving badly. This one is definitely more into like dark women's fiction / suspense. I really went there. It's like the most emotional thriller I've written.
Yes, no, I can definitely agree. And unfortunately, part of the reasons to read this book are things we can't discuss today because they will be awful spoilers. But it really is gripping as you read your way right to the end. Now, I had an interesting event earlier today, May, and we were talking about locked room mysteries. And the authors pointed out that a impossible crime or a locked room mystery is a cat and mouse game between the author and the reader. It's not between two characters in a thriller, but it's the author saying, you know, I've created this puzzle that you can't solve, and the reader going, yes, I can, back and forth. And I had really thought about that, you know, that because cat and mouse is used so often just in the context of thrillers, that there were other kinds of cat and mouse. So do you think that you were in part playing cat and mouse with a reader in this?
I was trying to more than my others. I really wanted to challenge myself to write more of like a closed circle Agatha Christie or, you know, like Ruth Ware in a dark, dark wood type mystery, something more traditional than my others, just to see if I could, to do something different, you know, to try to keep it fresh. And unlike the others, well, I guess I did know the villain in Summer Darlings, but I knew who it was from the outset. So I was, playing cat and mouse as much as possible.
Well, I think you succeeded really well with A Likeable Woman. Do you feel like, you know, at this point you're pretty much obliged to be writing about women in Texas?
That's funny you mentioned that. I do feel that way. However, the book that I just finished and I'm in edits on, it's actually set in Hollywood.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah. The main character's from Texas though, because I couldn't like completely leave it behind.
Right. I get it. You can't really leave your landscape. I read today that actors are thinking about going on strike in support of writers, in which case Hollywood, for the first time and I can never remember, which is a long time, like 80 years, might shut down.
Yeah, I think it will. I personally think it's a good thing. So the writers, yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I mean, you know, the fallout of COVID and other things like advancing technology are moving so fast that it's really hard for the paradigm of 3 or 4 years ago even, you know, to keep up and adjust. I mean, the book world is all disrupted and it doesn't help with all the political stuff going on, you know, with bookmans and all, and now the UPS strike. We were heading into the biggest and busiest August we've ever had, because usually it's like this orphan month. And now, you know, the whole shipping system may crater if in fact there's yet another strike. So I feel like every day, you know, you have to look around and wonder what's gonna hit us next.
I know. Everything feels a little unrelenting right now. My best friend and I say, like, what's the new manhole today that we're gonna fall through?
Very true. You know, there was something in the local news. Apparently, some woman actually did fall into one, which is not that funny. Out west here, the climate change is creating, you know, so many weird things happening. But she apparently fell down this giant hole, and they had to employ the firefighters and everything to lift her back out. So when you say what manhole, there might actually be one.
Yeah, and there's a literal one now. So that's
indeed. So let's talk a bit about, we could at least set the scene. So do you pronounce it Kira or Kyra?
Kira.
Okay, so tell us about Kira.
So Kira is a 30-something woman who lives out in LA, and she fled her tiny East Texas town a couple of decades ago in the wake of her provocative mother's mysterious death. Kira was told, like, ever since she was a teenager, that since it happened that her mom committed suicide, but she never believed it. She was like her mom's best friend, very close to her. Her mom was full of passion and life, and she always thought something else happened, but everyone else insisted she was crazy. So cut to now, she's in her 30s, and she gets an invitation to her frenemy's vow renewal party back in East Texas. So she gets beckoned back home by that. And then her grandmother, who's this sort of like manipulative matriarch of the family, texts her and says, I have something of your mother's, something she was keeping in secret. And I think you're right about how she died. And that, it's really not going to spoil it, but it's an unpublished memoir that her mom had, and it's called A Likeable Woman. And it reads almost like a letter to Kira, and it has a lot of clues in it about what might have happened. So Kira decides to go back, and as soon as she lands on Texas soil, and this is very tropey, but I wanted to play with tropes in this one, danger starts to lurk, and she gets ominous text, and other things happen because whoever might have been responsible doesn't want her to know the truth.
Okay, so define frenemy for me. I mean, you know, you. Is this an advanced version of Mean Girls?
Yes, exactly, Barbara. You hit the nail. I couldn't have defined it better. That's exactly what it is.
Wow. So, you know, I don't remember having one in my life other than when I was in junior high school, and there was a girl called, I even remember her name, Liza Moore, who just, I mean, God, that was 70 years ago. For some reason, you know, did that Mean Girl thing for a while. But other than that, I can't recall, you know, having to deal with it. Do you think that social media has really enhanced the opportunities for women to be horrible to each other?
I'm positive that it has. I mean, I haven't experienced it, but I can't imagine. I'll be 50 this year. I can't imagine being 15 and having to navigate, you know, how you look, how you present yourself, and what other people say about you on social media. I mean, it's hard enough for me as a complete adult to want to navigate it. So,
well, I mean, certainly the amplification, I think, is a big part. The stage is bigger. I can remember, because, you know, I was in high school in the 50s, which is an age of real conformity. And the cool girls would, you know, somehow or other get together and decide that everybody was going to wear saddle shoes one day, or everybody was going to wear their poodle skirt or whatever. And, you know, if you didn't luck into that, or perhaps you didn't even own that. And this was a very rich suburb, very rich high school, Winnetka, Illinois. So most everybody was affluent enough. It wasn't like, you know, there was going to be some huge class distinction between the people who could afford saddle shoes and the people who couldn't. It was more about if you were keeping up well enough to have nagged your mom to buy you saddle shoes, and then lucky enough to remember to wear them that day, because if you wore them on a different day when everybody else was wearing penny loafers, you know, you'd still look like a dork. But the thing is, it was contained to the high school. You know, it, there wasn't like, it didn't reverberate around people you didn't know. It didn't reverberate around the town. It didn't reverberate even in the junior high school. Even your family wouldn't know that you'd had a day of shame in school. So do you I think the scale of it makes a big difference.
I never thought about that, but that's, I think it's absolutely accurate. And now every time I talk to you, whenever you say something, I'm like, ooh, I want to write a book set in that time and in that place.
That's actually your stories would work extremely well then. You know, it's an era where I think, of course, you know, your books do take, I mean, social media is a part of your books and the way people interact with each other. But you might find it really interesting to go back when, you know, there was like a school newspaper and, you know, nobody had a cell phone. So it was all landlines and it'd be a different set of challenges for you.
Yeah, it would. I think it would be really cool and fun.
Well, if you come visit, we'll talk about it because I'm I'm a fountain of information about what it was like to go to high school back in the 1950s. Lord. Right. And it didn't help that it was such an age of conformity. It was much, much harder to be different. And, you know, it even extended to things like nobody would be caught dead with a tattoo. If you wore an ankle bracelet, you advertised that you were a slut. You know, nobody had pierced ears, nobody, I mean, there was none of that kind of individual expression. And now wherever you go, Rob and I were in the ice cream parlor the other night eating it because we went outside the ice cream, you know, it would have just totally puddled. And there was a three generation group and they were guys. And it was so interesting to see the older one with his kind of regular shirt and his, you know, butch haircut and, you know, his tennis shoes and socks and the whole bit. And then the next generation guy had the baseball cap backwards and weird facial hair and a sleeve and, you know, on and on. And then his two kids were kind of junior versions of that with more ink and jewelry and still the caps, you know, the caps weren't backwards and all. And I thought how interesting it was to see these like three generations of the difference between the grandfather and probably the younger kid, I would guess, was maybe like 12.
I'm sure that's, And it's interesting because I kind of, not intentionally, but like I loved having the Granny Foster character in there. So you have this very much like, she sort of like represents, you know, Southern wealth and more conformity. And then Kira doesn't because she's Sadie's daughter and she's more free-spirited a little bit and an artist, even though she's kind of locked into her own life. But I loved writing from that, you know, that that generation. I think she's probably like 85. I can't remember her exact age because I wrote the book, you know, 2 years ago, you know, it is, but she's probably my favorite character to write, the grandmother character. So
I really like the grandmother, and you know, I could relate to her since I'm roughly that age. But I was wondering if you saw like Kira and, you know, younger people, did you see them, you know, with ink and piercings and all the rest of it, or would that not really work in the upper echelons of East Texas? I don't even know what works anymore in various social strata.
I think for her, probably not. I think her generation is probably still probably not hitting the tattoo parlor. And it's probably because it's a small town more than anything. And she came up in the 90s. So yeah, not in her social class anyway.
I didn't remember you describing her, you know, that way. And certainly if you look at the cover, this lady in the bathing suit, while she has on a bracelet, has no trace of ink or facial or other piercings, no navel piercing, because we're actually down that far. So I was just kind of curious. I feel like, you know, it's getting harder to keep up and there's a tribalism going on all around us. And I wonder to what degree people are, I'm wondering if they're decking themselves out this way for expression, self-expression, or whether it's a kind of a tribe thing. Like you can usually tell a motorcycle gang, yeah, you know, by their leathers and their whatever it is. And I'm wondering if people are feeling more and more like they have to belong to some sort of a tribe.
I don't know. I really don't. Like I'm so averse to pain that while I think some tattoos are so beautiful and exquisite, I can't even get like, you know, initials. I don't even like to go to the dentist or the dermatologist. So I cannot even imagine right, that, but a lot of my friends have them and, you know, some family has them. And I just, yeah, I'm just a wimp, Barbara. I don't know.
Well, I will tell you that tattoos don't really wear well on aging skin. And there was, we did an event at the store not too long ago, and for various reasons I won't go into, I could really see that in terms of a couple of the people that were there. And it, you know, I don't think the kids ever imagined they could be old or their skin would wrinkle or, you know, all that. But anyway, it's just kind of interesting. So anyway, here's Kira, and she's back, and she gets a clue that reinforcement from her grandmother maybe, and some kind of a message or statement from her mother. Now, are most of the people that she's gone back to for this frenemies, it's like a, what, 20-year vowel renewal? Was that it? 20? I think it was 20 years, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So is it mostly the same people? There hasn't been much movement in the group in and out of town?
Yeah, there hasn't. Pretty much just about everyone other than Kira has remained in Longview, the small town, except for her childhood crush, Jack. And so he lives in Baltimore with his wife, and they're going to come back as well. But other than that, they've all stayed there. They've all lived more traditional lives than Kira. And there really is a tension because it's like she's going back to the lion's den. They don't really care about her. They want to know if her life is all that in LA, if like her picture with Keanu Reeves on Instagram, if like her life's like that, but they really don't want it to be good. You know, it's more like, well, how are you?
Right. Well, and you know, actually it's an interesting thing, but you wrote this book a couple of years ago before AI's, you know, suddenly been foisted upon us. I mean, it's perfectly possible that the argument could be now that, you know, it really was fake because it's going to be so easy to do that.
Yeah, that's true.
Another reason to write back in the 1950s. But no, I mean, I really think, you know, where there's a big social media presence in a story, the fact that social media may now be hijacked may create all kinds of permutations that you haven't thought of when it was much more straightforward.
That's kind of terrifying.
It really is. I mean, I've looked at my, you know, because I did the Instagram for the bookstore, or I've been doing it poking with one finger here for 3 weeks. And I really can hardly believe the change in the stuff that goes by in, you know, in the Instagram feed. There's clearly fake political stuff. There's, you know, an infinity of reels about dogs and kittens and, you know, all this other stuff. And the whole reason for Instagram, and also almost everything is monetized. So it's like one product and, you know, click here sort of thing after another. It seems to me that the original point of Instagram, which was to share photos with your friends and your family, has largely been hijacked.
Yeah, that's true. It has. And I don't... I know everyone's kind of going to different platforms, and I should probably like get on TikTok more, but I find that very overwhelming. So,
well, TikTok's going the same way. You know, I mean, it's being overtaken by influencer. I mean, who knew that you could be, you know, make a career with a fairly high salary by making videos for TikTok? But I mean, it's extraordinary. And so there's a ton of advertising in it. And now the people running Book Talk, I think it is, are starting their own publishing group because, you know, they've got a captive audience. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, I mean, none of the, you know, look at Threads versus Twitter going on. You're right that there's so many more of them proliferating as one of them gets corrupted. It's not at all clear that the next version, you know, Twitter stage three or something, now Threads, will be any better. So, I mean, I have a simple answer to it. I don't do social media. I do Instagram for the bookstore, and otherwise I have absolutely no social media. So all the anxieties and terrible things that I read about don't affect me at all because I don't really care.
I love that. I wish I could do that.
Well, you know, that there are some advantages to being old. One of them is you feel like you can do whatever you want. But no, I mean, it's an interesting thing. It's a challenge for running a business, you know, is to how much of that. But I think it's a challenge for an author, particularly an author like you, writing, you know, stories about contemporary women in difficult situations. And you can't really avoid the influence of social media on them and the communication channels and all the rest of it, the shaming possibilities, the bragging possibilities, the, you know, it used to be, you know, if you were a cool kid in high school, people didn't speak to you, but they now, what, they block you on Instagram and they ghost you and all these things. And there are a lot more ways to be mean than there used to be.
Oh my gosh, that's like a quote. That's like, I might have to steal that and put it in my next thriller. There's a lot more ways to be than there used to be. That's brilliant.
That's true. You know, and well, it's only in reading books like yours that I even know that, you know, because my regular life doesn't really incorporate any of this. So it's very good for me to, you know, to read what authors a generation or two younger than I am, you know, what you're writing about, what your concerns are and how people are relating to each other. I mean, for me, it's not just the story. It's really kind of an education.
That's interesting. And I feel like I'm, you know, I don't know how current I am, but it's interesting that you say that, because in the book I just finished, the woman, and it fits in with her character, she's kind of not on social media. And I think, like, subconsciously, I was tired of that. And I wanted, yeah. So we'll see.
Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Okay. Sorry. I couldn't tell if you cut out or what. Yeah. No. Well, anyway, so here's Kira getting back to the story. She's come back to East Texas, her wealthy small town, with roughly the same social structure and the same people that she knew before she left. And her grandmother, who's kind of a doyen, who might now be taking Kira's point of view about what happened to her mom.
Yes.
And the other person coming in and a pivotal character in this story is Jack, who was Kira's childhood friend, right?
Yes. Yeah. And Jack is really her only ally in this town. They were very close. They lived on the same block, like the same circle. They were the same age. She always had a crush on him. And then after, you know, her mom died, she left and left all that behind. But she would stay in touch with him. They would text. And Jack's a brain surgeon, and he's married. And he's got a son who's 3, and he's autistic. And so his life is sort of in a little challenging at the moment. And his marriage is a little bit on the rocks, which Kira's not like that sad about.
No, she's not. But on the other hand, you know, trying to deal with an autistic child in the mix is really difficult. But the child, from the moment they get off the plane, Jack and his wife, whose name I can't remember, the child, you know, presents all kinds of challenges, because it's hard for children like that to travel, hard for them to be in new situations. So yep. That's getting yet another level of conflict. Why did you decide to have an autistic child in the picture?
I guess I don't know if I've told you this, but my son is 10 and he's pretty severely autistic. And I feel like while there's more representation, there's not, it's more of higher functioning Asperger's autism and not what the challenges that people like my son have to face and what we as parents have to, you know, navigate. And it kind of came organically with Jack's character, but there was you know, more of a little bit of a social message in that.
No, I'm sorry. I imagine that is a daily challenge for you. And, you know, writing about it help?
It was tricky. I didn't know if I wanted to, you know, put it out there. And I had some discussions with my freelance editor that I work with, and then also my great editor at the publishers. And my freelance editor and I sort of decided that, you know, representation is important. And it's okay to go there and put it out there because it's a real thing. And there's still a lot of ignorance about it. You know, when we go out in public, it's amazing. Most people are really great, but then some there's not a lot of awareness about what that looks like. I think a lot of people, when they think of autism, they think of maybe like a quirky person that has trouble with social skills, but not the, as you spoke of, the behaviors and the challenges and the transitions. And I don't know, I wrote a piece for the Washington Post about it, and that was very cathartic, even if I had a lot of trolls come after me about it. It was, yeah, I think it's important to talk about, and it is a little bit of a release probably for me.
Is it at all predictable? I mean, you know, if you're going out, for example, is there any way to predict what kind of behavior you might see?
Yeah, for the most part it is. And my son's overcome a lot. He's come a long way. But when he goes through a rocky phase, it can be challenging. He's really good if we stick to the routine stuff and if he knows what is coming. But right now, like, we wouldn't feel comfortable really probably going and getting on an airplane and traveling to a different place with him. I think it would be a lot to navigate, but we're going to try and we're going to get back there because we all love to travel. He himself loves to travel, but it's, for instance, he doesn't like elevators. So if we go and stay at a hotel, maybe in San Antonio, we try to pick a place where, okay, we need to at least be on the second floor or lower, because he's actually, for whatever reason. They are kind of strange if you think about it.
I don't know. I think there are people who don't have autism who don't like elevators. So Linwood Berkeley wrote an absolutely phenomenal book in which elevators were the murder mechanism. And he pointed out, I'm trying to remember, it's called Elevator Pitch. Really great. Absolutely great thriller. But one of the things he pointed out was that, this is a total digression, that elevator technology is getting to the point where the elevator, when you push the button, can recognize you and let only you into the car and take you only to the place that you're supposed to go.
Okay, that's terrifying.
Well, I think it is true. But, you know, in a way, that's an interesting thought, whether the aversion to the elevator is being crowded in with other people, no sense of, you know, unknown destination. I mean, what would be the scary part, you know, of the elevator? So anyway, I was fascinated with that. And there's also, as I understand it, increasing, you know, looking at not just drugs, but other kinds of therapies for the neurodivergent, if that's the general umbrella that we're talking about. And, you know, so there may be advances or changes anyway coming for people that we can't anticipate at the moment. My sister, in the last years of her life, she caught encephalitis, and it led her to having dreadful epilepsy, which eventually killed her, or, you know, one too many falls and the whole bit. And, you know, you kept wishing that they could have, like, implanted some kind of, like, a pacemaker. And now I guess they can, you know, that there are implanted pacemaker kinds of things for people with epilepsy that try to regulate the, it's all bad electronics, you know,
Yeah, I'm so sorry to hear that. That had to be very terrible.
It was awful. It was awful for her, but it was awful for all the rest of us too. And you know, at that point, every 2 or 3 years, it seems to me that medical help, you know, doubles, and new ideas come along, and there's an increasing amount of research into the brain and how brain signals, you know, whether it can help paraplegics or whether it can help regulate epilepsy, or, you know, all the different things that are possible. So, you know, I can hardly believe, you know, we're lucky. We live right here with the Mayo Clinic, and my husband and I belong to their concierge medicine program. And I can hardly believe how high tech, you know, the whole thing is, the surgery is, for example. It's arthritis. If you're female and old and you've used your hands a lot, sometimes the ligaments don't hold up. And so my thumb had to be basically taken apart and put back together, and a big piece of it taken out. And, you know, the ligaments reattached and the whole thing. And you would think that that would be, you know, months worth of work, but they're able to cut it down to under a month. And, you know, do all these things to make it work. The cast is made out of fiberglass. It's not plaster. I had a choice of 14 colors for my cast. Isn't that exciting? I could have had purple or fluorescent green or turquoise. They did say that black would show the dirt less. And so that was their recommendation. But, you know, if you wanted to flirt around, you could have all kinds. And I was remembering the days of plaster casts, you know, when I was young and you fell out of a tree and broke your arm or something, you know, and you got this white lump. So, yes.
Yeah.
Right. And the reason we're talking all around it is that we can't really talk to you about this story, because unfortunately, now that we've set it up, if we say almost anything, it's going to spoil it, because, you know, here are the questions. Was Kira's mom murdered? If she was murdered, why was she murdered? And if she was murdered and you know why she was murdered, then you might know who it was. And it's a pretty small group of suspects. As May said, she was emulating kind of an Agatha Christie village or country house murder. So we can't really go any farther, because then we start giving away spoilers. And it takes May, let me see how many pages here, 370, no, not quite. 385 pages, no, 65 pages to bring this book to a conclusion. So there's a lot to travel in all here. So tell me about the notes, because you have some really nice notes about people who helped you. And one of them I saw that you mentioned is our dear friend Luis Alberto Uria, who's friend of Patrick's.
He's so great, right?
He is. He's lovely. Patrick did an event with him not long ago. And you say that he saved your writing life years ago by inviting you to the cabin. What was that?
Yeah. So, yeah, that was so magical. I went to one of his readings at Book People, and I was getting him to sign my book. And I don't know if he just picked up on my desperation or what, but he said, "Are you a writer?" And I said, "Yes." And I told him about the nonfiction book I was working on. And he said, "Ah." And then he wrote down this email address. And he said, "Email this person, and I have this secret online writing group." And I was like, "What?" Because I'm such a huge fan of his, I couldn't believe it. And it was this place called Cabin 20, and it's no longer. And we mainly hang out on Facebook. I mean, I'm still in touch with everyone, but it was probably 30 of us and 20 who were very active. And anyone from, you know, maybe like someone who's 25 to someone who's 75, people who've been published to people who've never even, you know, written that much, like me at that time. And Luis was kind of guiding us, and he would share. I remember he shared this incredible essay he wrote. I'm going to get botched the title, but Mr. Smith is in the title. Anyway, it's all about battling that inner critic. And an interesting thing was, I was very blocked with my nonfiction book, and I wanted nothing more than to write and to finish. And one thing that was big in the cabin was haiku. So we would, like, you know, the 5-7, you know, traditional, and that really unlocked a lot for me. And then the next thing I know, I was writing more. and having, we would check in with each other almost daily. And Luis was kind of fading out a little bit because so busy. But, you know, some of my best writing friends I met there, and we're still in touch. And it was really so magical. And I feel like without that, I don't know that I would have found my voice and gotten over, you know, getting out of my own head. So I have so much gratitude to him for letting me be a part of that.
Wow, that's a wonderful story. He is an absolutely delightful man. Patrick edited an anthology some years ago, and Louis' short story won the Edgar.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yep. That's amazing. And I suspected, for reasons I won't share, that Louis had won the Edgar, and I tried to... Are you listening to this, Patrick? Because I tried to get Patrick to go to the Edgars. I couldn't actually tell him why he needed to go, but I really did want him to go. And I was happy to send him there, but he didn't. So when Luis got his award, you know, there I was sort of representing the poison pen, but I was so pleased for him because, you know, that's a real career, not milestone, but it's that kind of recognition is great, you know, for an author to win a major award like that. Not all of his books, in fact, I don't think many of his books are actually crime novels. I mean,
no.
The new one is, you know, based on his mother's choices during working in the Red Cross mobiles in France, or yeah, in the Western Front. In World War II. And, you know, he's written books about the Southwest and his heritage and so forth. So he's a very versatile guy.
Yeah.
And I'm always impressed that people can write short stories and novels because they think they are so different. And I'm always amazed. Somebody like Jeffrey Deaver just astonishes me.
Oh, me too. I don't... I've written one short story in my life, and it was when I was 20, and it was because I had a dream. I would get crippled if someone and terrified asked me to write a short story. I even have a hard time with like writing, you know, essays and short pieces. I find them so much harder than like an 80,000 word novel.
I hear you. I'm trying to remember who wrote that famous line, you know, it was, I think, somebody like Robert Benchley, although I could be wrong. But anyway, he said to somebody once, he said, you know, I would have written shorter, but I didn't have enough time, or words like that, you know, which is really true, because, you know, to really do well, you have to pare things down, you know, you have to edit it and pare it down and take out all those words that readers skip. And you know, if you're writing a short story, you have to have just a focus on the single plot. You can't digress all over the place.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me that somebody who can do that can then turn around like Jeffrey and open up and write, you know, a great big book with lots of characters and plot points and the whole bit. So yeah. It's so interesting. Our brains are all wired so differently.
They are. And then Luis, I'm sure you've witnessed this. The last time I saw him at Book People was for, I don't know why I'm spacing on the title. It was the one right before the pandemic that came out, The House of Broken Angels. And he got up a chapter completely from memory.
Wow.
And it was in, you know, he's like an actor up there, you know, performer. And the whole room was just holding their breath and mesmerized. And I was like, I don't know how, like, I could never remember a whole chapter. It was long and fascinating.
Well, I'm so much more interesting than having him reading it.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, acting it or declaiming it is, I mean, because I've thought for years that the most boring book events were when the author is reading. I mean, you know, I know people don't come, at least in our experience, do not come to listen to an author read. They come to listen to the author talk about things. But anyway, he's really wonderful indeed. So what, can you want to talk a little more about the book you are writing or the book you've finished and are editing?
I would love to. It is my first book novel set outside of East Texas. Like I said, it's set in Hollywood. And it's kind of Rear Window-esque. And Yeah. And I haven't read this book yet, only because I didn't want to get, you know, too influenced by it, but I'm going to read it soon. The Housemaid. Have you read that one yet?
The Housemaid. There's a marvelous book called The Housekeepers by Alex Haid that I can truly recommend. And I'll tell you a book that would stop your heart. It doesn't come out until September. We're going to do a little preview launch. It's called Mother-Daughter Murder Night. And it is an extraordinary book. It's part Delia Owens and Crawdad and part, I'm trying to think of whatever her name is that wrote The Maid. I don't think I've ever read a book like it. And you would be absolutely crazy about Lana, the mother, since you like the grandmother in this book so much. Lana would really speak to you. And there are three generations. There's the older woman, and then there's the kind of, I think she might be 30-ish, maybe close to 40 daughter. And then there's the 15-year-old. And it really is just, it's really great. And it does have a plot. I mean, it has a murder plot, but it's just an incredible book. I read it. I read it day before yesterday, and I'm still thinking about it.
Oh, it I'm sounds amazing.
Going back and increase my order by a lot, yeah. Right? To see where we are. Anyway, it's a book I would recommend. And, you know, I'm glad you're doing something a little bit different.
Thank you. Yeah. And I, with the new one that I'm in edits on, the Rear Window Esplanade, I wanted to, you know, get out of East Texas for a minute and get into. So I was a personal assistant in LA, and I worked for this lovely couple, but the couple I wrote about, we don't know what's going on with them. And I love, you know, I love The Woman in the Window so much. And I love sort of the nods to film noir in that book. And I wanted to, you know, write something in that vein where someone is kind of swept up into trying to see what's going on. I don't want to give too much away because I'm like, no. I said, I'm, but yeah, it was, no, fun.
And it's interesting too. I keep waiting for AJ Finn, a pseudonym. I keep waiting for him to write another book. And, you know, every year goes by, and I don't remember how long ago was that one out, 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah. Yeah.
Before COVID, for sure.
Yeah. I would love to read another one and another one and another one. I think he's such a terrific, phenomenal storyteller.
Yeah, he's a great storyteller. I'm not sure, you know, that if you write a book like that, though, where you go for your next inspiration.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope we find out, because that book has really like stuck with me. I reread it, you know, it's so great.
Right. So do you watch the movie on a regular basis?
I watched it. I really liked it. It's funny, Barbara, I don't really watch that many movies or TV shows at the moment. I find whenever the kiddo's asleep, I want to pick up a book and stay current. And so I'm the rare person where TV won't win out to a book, but you know, and there's also like a stack of books to blur, but I'm always wanting to read those because I like to read things before they come out. And if it's for a friend or writer I really admire, it's such an honor. So I'm kind of behind on a lot of shows and whatnot.
Well, I'm not surprised by that, but I mean, Rear Window is such a classic. If you're writing something in that style, it seems to me that you almost have to, you know, you have to reacquaint yourself with it.
Yeah. Yes.
There are several Hitchcock movies that are really seminal for crime fiction. I mean, not just as films, but as storytelling for, you know, for crime. He was a master of some of the things that, you know, we see in current crime fiction. Not just Rear Window, but I'm trying to think of.
I watched Vertigo recently.
Yeah, I'm sorry, that's what I was trying to think of. Vertigo, you know, which is a whole question of unreliable narrators and misdirection. And, you know, I remember when he did, of course, it was Agatha Christie, but A Witness for the Prosecution was, you know, another really nifty piece of misdirection. And
I need to watch that. I haven't seen that one.
It's wonderful. And you know, this, these are older actors who, you know, have a different style and so forth, but really worth appreciating. But I think, you know, for the kind of storytelling you want, it probably is useful to watch something like that every now and then. But I know what you mean about reading. It's a quiet place. And, you know, whenever I have a chance, that's what I prefer to do, is settle in with a book and not leap online or scroll through my, you know, scroll through Instagram or, you know, watch something on TV and avoid politics at all costs and, you know, like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did, for this book, I did rewatch all the great like 90s erotic thrillers, like Fatal Attraction and Sick Instinct. And I love those because there's just, I don't know, there's something timeless about that.
Well, absolutely is. I mean, those are just modern version of stories that you could read. You know, when I was in college, I had a French minor, and, you know, we read things like Les Liaisons Dangereuses, which are, you know, 18th century French. And believe me, the dynamics of the story were very similar to the kind of thing you're talking about in Fatal Attraction. But a lot of cross-dressing, I might point out. So a lot of fun. I did an interesting talk yesterday with Kate Moss, who has a wonderful new book out called The Ghost Ship, which you think is really about pirates, but it's not. It's really about women and the republic that you, that sort of republicanism that prevails on a ship, especially a ship captained by a woman. But, you know, I said to her, the things that come to mind when you're talking about being at sea for a long time, especially with women, are, you know, what are the things that readers are wondering about? They're wondering about diet. What did they eat? They're wondering about hygiene. How does anybody manage that? And you wonder about sex. And Kate pointed out that, you know, for centuries, people were never seen naked. They only had maybe one set of clothes. They didn't really wash all over, you know, so you could get away with a lot of stuff because you were never undressed.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Which I haven't thought about, but it's really, you know, very, very true that you could manage that. Whereas today, you know, in the kind of clothing we wear, it's virtually impossible to do something like that.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So Patrick, we are devolving into so many asides here because we can't talk about the book. We probably should bring you in and see if there are any questions. Or you can come and talk to us about Luis Alberto Uria because you're a big fan.
Yeah, can you see me? Am I on the screen? I am. Okay, there we go. Yeah, no, he's great. He's really, really such a wonderful writer.
What was the story he won the Edgar for in that book anthology that you edited?
Oh, it was called Amapola. And yeah, it was really, really great story.
Yeah. Why was it a great story?
It's interesting because he, some of the most interesting results come when you ask a writer to, who doesn't necessarily write in the crime genre, you know, to go for it, you know. And he's like, "Well, I don't write mystery or crime fiction, and I just go for it, you know." And he did. He wrote this really wild story that was kind of surrealistic and really effective. You know, it was great. Yeah, I don't know if I could say why it's great. It's just it's just his writing and his style and
the
unexpected. Yeah. And he did a really great one for the highway kind as well. Kind of a psychedelic story set in Mexico. He's really something else. Yeah.
Yeah,
I would like to see him write a straight crime novel. I know he reads a lot of crime fiction.
Yeah.
So, and he could write a knockout crime story.
Yeah, he can write anything. It's the novelist Sarah Bird once said of Luis, she said, "I'm just honored to share the same alphabet with him." And that's how I feel too.
That's really a nice thing. I like that. That's a great way to put it. So do we have any questions from the audience, Patrick?
Let's see.
Do you have any questions?
May, I was going to ask you, do you know Joe Lansdale?
I do, yeah. We were just on a panel at the Texas Book Festival together, and we had the best time. We were like cackling, and I mean, we just, it couldn't, yeah. He's a big hero of mine because, you know, he's from East Texas too.
Right.
Nacogdoches, right.
Yeah, yeah. So right down by this, like an hour from my hometown.
Where is your hometown?
Longview, Texas.
Longview, okay. Where just, is that in relation to Nacogdoches?
It's like an hour north.
North, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Nacogdoches, you know, really interesting, a real interesting history, you know, as sort of a crossroads of all these different trails.
Yeah.
And so, you know, lots of traveling medicine shows would come through there, and revivals, and you know, of course, that made a big impression on young Joe.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And he's from Gilmer, which is even closer to Longview, and so we had a lot of laughs about that. But it's a really, East Texas is just sort of like this very, obviously he and I are both obsessed with it. It's very noir part of Texas, because you have this lush, insanely like deep, thick, piney wood forest. And it just, the minute you cross into the, it's called the Pine Curtain, there is a vibe. And you know some bad stuff has happened there. And you don't know what it is, but it's just in the air. It's crazy.
Huh. Interesting. Almost like a Teutonic sort of
yeah. You know,
the forest. And yeah, I remember his book, The Bottoms, was really explored a lot of that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. Great.
Yeah, I love Joe. Hope to see him soon. I saw him. He came through Book People, so I got to see him for the Donut Legion. And then I just got to read an early copy of his collection that's coming out soon. Things Get Ugly.
I got that too. Yeah.
Yeah. just terrific.
Who are some of your other kind of influences, if you have any?
Yeah, I'm huge Riley Sager fan. I love each and every one of his books, and I'm so happy to call him a friend too. And he's, you know, a mentor. When I get stuck, he'll hop on the phone with me and talk me through some things. And I find him to be like such a masterful plotter. I love Tawna French. I love Tawna French's Ireland. I love her lush prose, the way she writes a sentence, paragraphs. I mentioned A.J. Finn before, but he looms large for me. Gosh, I'm always tongue-tied when asked this, but yeah, those are some main ones that come to mind. I just read a book, Girls and Their Horses by Eliza Jane Brazier.
That's a really interesting book, isn't it? I was so pleased to have a conversation with her. I thought it was a marvelous book.
Isn't it just wonderful? I mean, I couldn't get enough of it. I love that it's suspense, but it's also soapy and juicy and nasty and dramatic. And I found that so fresh. You know,
women behaving badly, May, it's your thing.
It is. I can't get enough.
I know. It's so funny. Oh.
What's wrong with me?
No, it isn't that. I didn't mean it that way at all. I just, you know, I think it's interesting the kind of stories. See, I'm actually attracted to more linear stories because I have a logical mind. And so I really like police procedurals and Private Eye novels and all that, you know, where there's something happens and then you kind of move forward towards working it out. So I'm not as crazy about the, you know, the twisty kind of a thing, because it's just, my mind doesn't go that way, I guess. It may be.
Yeah.
Interesting. Definitely you want to read Mother Daughter Murder Night.
I can't wait.
It's a revelation.
Uh-oh, I froze up. Are y'all there still?
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.